At odds with his father, Tom had left home as a boy, and now his parents were dead, he drifted like the twigs and leaves on the river.
I've never done anything like this before, so I don't know how I'll do at it, but I suppose reading things into a microphone, I should be able to do that.
And you got out of the car, pulled down the fly and pissed all over the roses. This is on a Sunday afternoon. It's a beautiful summer Sunday afternoon. That was the end of that. Oh God, we just thought it was brilliant after that.
This is Anne Enright's voice, all right. Wry, disabused, reckless, candid and funny. It's a huge pleasure to welcome to the stage Anne Enright.
Now, I'll in fact actually do two. Now, you'll be sorry, you see.
He's a pestant, I can't argue.
You are listening to Red Line Readings, which was recorded live at Civic Theatre Tala as part of South Dublin Library's Red Line Book Festival Readers' Day. In this programme, you will hear Dermot Bulger in conversation with Sean Moncrief. We are joining Dermot at the Civic Theatre as he introduces Sean to the audience. Red Line Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland fund.
The next author is the author of God, A User's Guide, among his many novels, and sort of the great priest and poet Thomas Merton was once asked what star sign he was born under, and he said that he was born under the sign of contradiction. And Sean Moncrief, as a Cockney culture, is also a man of great contradiction, because he was born in London but moved to Ballinasloe and Galway. His novels include Dublin, A History of Things, and this new book. And did you know at Christmas where you actually you're able to track now the progress of Santa Claus on satellite, which was your children on a computer. And myself and Sean have been tracking the progress of this book across the world for the past week to see would it reach Tala in time. The Angel of the Street Lamps, a wonderful new thriller set in with a lot of resonances, a lot of sort of things walking through it, which has just literally arrived. You can smell it off the press, and Sean's going to read from it, and we're going to have a little chat. So it's, you know, a man who's known to you from radio, known to you from television, but is here as a really, really fine novelist. Sean Moncrief.
Afternoon. I've never done anything like this before, so I don't know how I'll do at it, but I suppose reading things into a microphone, I should be able to do that. I should explain, before I read this piece to you, the context of where it kind of comes in the book, and generally speaking, what the book is about. It is called The Angel of the Street Lamps, and it's the story of five different people who are not ostensibly connected to each other, but they become connected to each other in odd sorts of ways through one particular event. That event is that at the start of the novel, a young woman falls out of a window and lands in a skip, and obviously dies as a result of this. One of the characters, for instance, is a priest who happens to be passing and gives her the last rites. The person I'm going to read is called Rachel Belton. She's another one of these five characters. There's a general election going on at the time. She hasn't been having a great campaign so far. She said a few impolitic things to the press, and so the papers are kind of hard on her, as it is anyway. But what happens when this young woman falls out the window is that she actually hits one of Rachel Belton's election posters, and the poster lands on top of her when she lands in the skip. It being the age that we're living in, people immediately start taking photographs of this with their phones, and it's on the internet within minutes, which obviously isn't seen to be a particularly good thing for Rachel Belton's career. Now, Rachel Belton already has a public profile because she was very well known before she became a politician as a model. And surprisingly for a model, she ended up marrying a really rich guy. And the really rich guy, his name is Daniel, and he comes from quite an eccentric family, in that his mother and his aunts were all keen spiritualists. It would be quite normal for Daniel to come home from school and they're all in the sitting room talking to dead people. So he's got kind of a cheery attitude towards the dead, in the sense that he thinks they're kind of all around us all the time. That's to give some context to what I'm going to read to you here. And this particular section is a little bit about a difficulty they had, or a difficult period they had in their marriage. Before they got married, he was a mountain climber. And as she only agreed to marry him if he gave up being a mountain climber, because obviously she was terrified he was going to kill himself. I should also point out that these five stories are all first-person narratives. I actually wrote each one at a time and then intercut them with each other. So it's the person speaking in their own voice. So I'm going to be reading to you as a rather attractive former model. So maybe a little bit of suspension of disbelief might be required for that now. Maybe you should all close your eyes. Okay, here we go. In the Russian Orthodox Church, a bell is not regarded as a musical instrument. Unlike Western European church bells, the Russian version is not tuned to a major or minor chord. Each has its individual sound, where the intention is not to play melodies, but to produce bone-clanging layers of rhythm. The Russian church bell must be loud and distinctive, because its function is to represent the voice of God. Funny the things that stay with you. When Daniel rang from Sergeyev Posed and told me this, so breathy and excited, I remember every word. I suppose because it had been such a long time since he had displayed enthusiasm for anything. The monks had let him touch one of the bells afterwards. The sensation had been like an electric shock. The voice of God. Isn't that extraordinary? Giving up the mountains had been far more difficult for him than we imagined. Being Daniel, he didn't issue a word of complaint, but we both had to live with his unease, the unspoken suspicion that he had ceased to make sense. He set up a charity to help injured climbers, to remind himself why he'd given up, he said, but he lost interest after a few months and handed it over to someone else. He tried the lecture circuit for a while, but he was never comfortable in front of audiences. He talked about writing a book, but never made it past jotting down a few notes. The new house in Dalkey kept him occupied for a while. We could have had it all done by builders, of course, but Daniel insisted on doing as much as possible himself. I like it when I'm sweating, he said, when I have cuts on my hands. I wanted to cry. I wanted to tell him to grow up. The climbing school was my idea, inspired mostly by my need to get him out of the house. At first he wasn't keen, he didn't feel he had the patience to teach, but soon he realised that at least this was a job where he could be outside, climbing something, sweating, cutting his hands. It was a compromise for me. You can break your neck just as easily in Wicklow, but at least he was coming home every evening. The bell, though, that's what I think brought it back, all the hocus-pocus from his childhood. I suppose you can never escape. And then I got pregnant, and he was off doing up the bedroom, installing monkey bars so the child could kill itself before getting up for breakfast. I made him take them out and put them in the back garden. He put in a sandbox in the bedroom instead, which was also moved to the garden. Life with Daniel, as I'd hoped, wasn't dull. I woke up bleeding a few weeks later, and the doctor shrugged and said, "Sorry, you've lost that one. Sorry." I'd been 7 weeks pregnant. How to react was what threw me. At times I felt the acute pinch of grief, then nothing, then guilt for feeling nothing. So much of our emotions are instructed, and I longed for someone to tell me how to feel, to point to a place on a chart, like the death of a family member, but less so. You should experience 50% of the anguish that you might feel, say, if you lost a brother. The gynecologist said there was no particular reason. These things just happen. Daniel kept asking, "Yes, but what does it mean? What does it mean?" And he kept asking when we got home, as if I could summon an answer, as if there was some secret guide to my reproductive organs which I could show him. Eventually I screamed, "How do I know?" He retreated to the cold little room, which at the time he called his office. I went to bed. We spent several weeks at this odd sort of mourning, missing a person we'd never met, who hadn't existed. Is it enough to imagine a person to make them real? By not imagining, do we deny them existence? I don't know what Daniel was doing all this time, though I can guess. I spent much of it infuriated with myself for even being subject to these feelings, and the rest wondering why there was no one I could ask for help. The hospital never rang to see how I was doing. My mother rang once or twice, but was clearly uncomfortable. And anyway, I insisted to anyone who asked that I was perfectly fine. Daniel's mother never rang at all, which didn't surprise me. Odd as they are a family that values fortitude. You don't complain. You don't cry. You get on with it. I've always admired them for this. Nonetheless, I did start to wonder if there shouldn't be some sort of counselling system for women in my position, something which should kick in immediately. To distract myself, I decided to find out if such services exist in Ireland or in any other country, and then I forgot to. Daniel emerged from his office and seemed fine, and I was strong enough again to present my public face. We got on with it, and I was proud of that. The second lasted nearly 15 weeks. I had to have a D&C to make sure I had expelled all the fetal material. Fetal material. Sucked out of me like so much rubbish. This time Daniel shouted at the gynaecologist, who remained impassive, who said this wasn't indicative of anything. Said I could obviously conceive without too much difficulty. You can do it again. You don't smoke. You've stayed away from the alcohol and coffee. There are no signs of hormonal imbalances or an incompetent cervix. For some reason, for some people, it just happens. Just bad luck. Bad luck. You call this bad luck? We went home and argued about it all the way he had spoken to the consultant. I went to bed, he went to his office. And this time I couldn't help but wonder if all this was due to some weakness in me, some deficiency, too cold, too businesslike, not maternal enough. My womb as a hostile environment. Get a move on, kid. I've things to do. But over a mostly silent breakfast, the slight tremor in Daniel's chin brought me to realise that he felt the same about himself. Some problem with his sperm, his milk poisoned. We had no idea how to go about fixing this. We had believed everything could be fixed. So we both became website junkies, entertaining every half-baked dietary regime, every study which claimed that you should sit for 9 months or stand or dance. We chose what seemed sensible. As a climber, Daniel knows something about body chemistry. 10 weeks, 11 weeks, 12, 14. A crumb of hope. We can fix this. After 15 and a half weeks, I woke up with the sheets drenched in globs of blood. I didn't even want to go to the hospital, and at first I refused. I lay there in the red pool, sobbing, while Daniel tried to coax me up, until he lost his temper and roared, "For God's sake, Rachel, don't be so bloody weak!" I said nothing in the car. I hated him then. He spoke rapidly, like a child reciting a poem they've learned by rote. He told me that crying is a good thing, a healthy thing, that I needed to grieve for my dead babies because that's what they were. They were innocent beings who'd passed over. But they are happy now, he said. They're in the light. And the only sadness they carry is the knowledge of our pain, of our refusal to think of them as people, the same as anyone you would see on the street. I gave the first two names, he told me. They wanted them. Jane and Tom. They're called Jane and Tom. When we got out of the car, I smacked him across the face. I went away after that, visited some old college friends in New York. I didn't tell him where I'd gone or how long I'd be away. I wasn't leaving Daniel so much as experimenting with the idea, seeing how it fitted. It was unendurable. I returned to Ireland, to our home. That was barely tolerable either. But Daniel is a patient man and, like me, almost unstoppable when convinced he's right. While I had been away, splashing around in doubt, he'd become more certain that speaking to our dead children was the only way to find solace. There were three now, Jane, Tom, and Emily. For weeks we barely conversed, but he chipped away at me, solicitous and deferential. He would ask how I was, until eventually I returned something more than an offhand reply. We sat in our grand, empty dining room, Daniel three seats away. I spoke about what I did in New York, my desolation in a midtown hotel room, and my fury with him, with our families, with the world. I cried. We hugged. It felt appropriate. Nothing more. 3 days later, he coaxed me down to a shrine. You don't have to believe, he said. Just see what it's like, if it makes you feel better. He'd taken out the desk, the seat and any pictures, stripped the room bare, and in their place built a wooden teepee-like structure, my dream tent. I thought, this should be funny. I should be laughing. Inside, there were dozens of candles, and on one of the walls was carpeted with various symbols I didn't recognise, some in frames, some apparently ripped from magazines. The second wall was blank, painted a pristine white, while the third featured three pencil drawings. Each was of a figure in shadow, without any discernible features. "It's how I see them," he said. "Like shadows, but I hear them clearly. I feel them. That's the important thing." I said, "Who?" already knowing the answer. "The kids. They are our kids." I didn't reply. I dumbly let him sit me down and cross my legs, relax, breathe slowly. He set about lighting the candles, pausing before each one as if repeating some secret incantation. The candles threw multiple orange shadows of him against the tent walls, which eventually coalesced into a long-headed, beaky creature. I watched the shadow as he sat back beside me and breathed, "Children, come to Mummy and Daddy. Look, Mummy is here." My first jet of vomit put out half the candles, and as I crouched on my hands and knees, waiting for the rest to come, it struck me again that this should be funny. I should be laughing. Daniel cleaned me up and put me to bed. I told him it might be best if he moved out for a few days. I only wanted him out of the house so I could destroy that thing, set it on fire, take the rest of the house if needs be. But I couldn't. I didn't have the courage to go down the stairs, just in case he was right, in case some floating grey versions of my children were down there, wondering why I didn't believe in them. I spent 3 days cleaning, convinced that the smell of my sick was everywhere, but afraid to descend to that room where I'd thrown up. I wrote letters to government ministers and local TDs, fuming about the lack of support and counselling, to organisations in the US and Britain, to mothering websites around the world. Then I rang the gynaecologist and told him I wanted every test he could think of, relevant or not. I wanted them. I was paying. Daniel returned unannounced, the harrowed look on his face, enough for me to let him back in. I probably conceived again that day. They tested me for blood pressure and diabetes, chromosomal abnormalities, nephritis and tumours. They put me on Clomid and prescribed total bed rest for the first 3 months. I got letters back from some of the TDs inviting me to meetings. I said, "I can't. I'm pregnant." This time I did see the face of my dead baby, squeezed out of me 2 days before she was due to arrive. She suddenly stopped moving, and I knew. We called her Adele. We had a sort of funeral, which we hardly attended. I was zonked on tranquilizers. Daniel had succumbed to a sort of fever, wild-eyed and sweaty, watching our dead family swirling around him. He tried to bring me down to the shrine several times, like a drunken man trying to seduce a woman, half coaxing, half dragging. I scraped his face and neck. He left a sequence of black bruises on my shoulders. I flew to London and got my tubes tied. I didn't consult Daniel, didn't feel I needed to. To be honest, I didn't know if I would ever see him again, if we would ever emerge from his astral fog. But he did, mostly. He texted. I flew home and told him I wanted to adopt. We got Nisha less than 6 months later, and we've let him fill the house with his noises and smells. We try not to spoil him. I'm not a great mother. So, or at least, I'm not one of those who could happily stay at home and watch him grow. I'm not the domestic type. Neither of us are. We become uneasy if we're in the same place for too long. And it must be said, Daniel and I are still careful about how much time we spend together. Grief has made him a dreamer. I don't know what it's done to me. I have one child. Daniel has five. The material and the spiritual. There's still love there, of course. And for the sake of that love, we work around it. We don't mention it. We don't show our scars to each other. That's it.
That is a tough and a beautiful piece of writing.
Yeah.
And did you find it hard to get into a woman's voice in that way?
You'll know this yourself. Writing is mostly rewriting, and most days you're grinding it out and you think it's nonsense. For some reason, though, that particular passage just came fully formed.
Yeah.
I hardly had to rewrite it, and I don't know why. I have no idea why. I have four children myself, and maybe that the thought of losing them is what Actually, I find that piece quite upsetting. I find that kind of even slightly difficult to read.
It is upsetting. But do you think, as a writer, that sometimes you write your worst fear?
Yes. Yeah.
As a way of keeping fear at bay, almost. As against not talking about it, you actually simply talk about it in this other way. As if it happens in a book, it can't happen to you.
Mm. Yeah, to a degree. And so, it's funny when you read something afterwards, especially after it's been published. Well, you generally just avoid reading whatever written after it's been published. But it's funny, you can spot you're channeling things yourself that you didn't know were there at all when you were first putting
it down. And throughout the book, there's this great sense of a void, of people needing something to believe in, of people saying, needing something to spiritual to cling on to, in a sense. And moving to your other life of a radio show presenter, I always find it fascinating as a listener, you will let people on who have quite ludicrous views on, who believe they've been adopted by aliens and taught how to write music like Mozart, whatever, and you will just simply give them the space to actually, no matter how deluded they are, you will never interrupt them, and you will actually give them the space to simply, this is what they believe in. And I mean, is all belief certainly delusional at a certain level?
All belief is a fiction, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
We'd particularly subscribe to that view that and all beliefs are stories of sorts, they're narratives. Mm-hmm. And say, for instance, in the case of straightforward Christian belief, there's a theologian by the name of Karen Armstrong, who's a former nun and then left that. But she's written for 20 years, and she knows her stuff, where essentially her thesis is that, yes, there were Jews and many religions cross-pollinate each other in terms of their belief, but at some point, probably around the 3rd century, it became incumbent upon people who were Christians to believe all that literally. Mm-hmm. Constantine was the person who said, no, this is all literally true. Up to that point, her contention is, you would interpret it. These were ways of explaining the world.
Yeah.
And they were essentially about why is the world here, or as opposed to not being here. And most importantly, how should we live? Mm-hmm. And people told each other stories and made up stories. But the fact that it was made up didn't make it any less true, if you see what I mean.
It was a different type of truth.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a novel that is about like post-Celtic Tiger Ireland. It's very tangible, very real about that. But it's also about a yearning for belief and a yearning for something to actually cling to. So, in terms of the character, what came first to you, the sense of writing about Ireland or about writing about this void in people's lives?
I think it came... I had the, as you sometimes do, I had the image of the girl falling out a window wearing a bridesmaid's dress.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd had that years ago and I had no idea where it would fit into anything. There's a character in it called Morris, who's a taxi driver. Mm-hmm. And Morris is, he drives at night. He's a kind of a sad character. But in him, there's a kind of an innate sense of decency. But he's been quite unlucky, though, and he's penchant towards violence. But he wants to see the world be a fair place. Mm-hmm. He's actually based on an email that was sent in to me years ago into the radio show from a taxi driver who described driving into a garage in the middle of the night, and a few young fellas were terrorizing the guy behind the counter.
Mm.
So he got out of the taxi and beat the crap out of them.
Yeah.
And he wasn't being proud about that, but he was saying, well, more people should do that kind of thing. Now, there would be chaos if more people did that. And while that is somewhat a perverted idea, it still stems from a need for things to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And like what's happened in this country is not just a recession. Everything else that we've believed in has fallen apart in the last 20 years. We can't believe, there was even during the height of the boom, there was a secularization process going on anyway, even before all the child abuse scandals. But the church essentially as a moral force, as a body to tell us what's right or wrong, has disintegrated. We don't believe in business anymore. We don't believe in banks anymore. We don't believe in politicians anymore. To an extent, we don't believe in each other anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because something I hear on the radio show, and you see it in the media all the time, is a circle of everybody blaming everybody else.
Yeah.
If you're in the public service, you're to blame because you're sucking the straight. If you're unemployed, you're to blame. Mm. If you're a politician, you're to blame. If you're a bank, you're to blame. Writers are probably to blame somewhere or the other. The media is definitely to blame. There's hardly a group within society that isn't being blamed by some other group. And we're like a family. We've turned in on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we're eating ourselves to a certain extent. And I always got this, and I always felt this during the Celtic Tiger anyway. I didn't quite believe it when you would read all those things about how confident we were now, and suddenly we'd arrived, and all of, you know, we had this 800-year-old inferiority complex, and suddenly it just disappeared. And I don't believe it did. And I believe there's this awful sense now that we failed as a country. Mm-hmm. And it, also a sense that we, there's something we can't forgive ourselves for. But that's what we really need to do. We really need to forgive ourselves for whatever it is we hold against ourselves as a society and kind of accept the fact that we're as good as anybody else. Mm-hmm. But I think we have genuine doubts about that. Mm-hmm. And especially when, you know, when there are no totems anymore in our country, there's nothing sacred anymore, we're at ground zero in a mm-hmm. sense that we have to mm-hmm. maybe come up all over again, come up with a new set of beliefs, mm-hmm. a new set of common beliefs mm-hmm. about what kind of people we want to be and what kind of a country we want to have.
I was listening to Anne Havis, the editor of the editor of the Irish, the Sunday Independent now, and the widow of Angus Fanning, mm-hmm. Talking a few weeks ago at some awards thing. And she said about Angus, about the different stories about Angus, who was an extraordinary sort of figure. And Colin Tobin used to do a lot of work for Sunday Independent, and then he went in and told Angus that he was going to take a year off and going to write a novel called The South. And Angus looked at him in absolutely incredulous disbelief and said, you're going to give up writing newspaper articles that reach 500,000 people so you can write a novel that's going to be read by 600 people. And is there a sense of this thing? Because as somebody who's involved in the media and writes for a newspaper column and then presents radio, and you're actually able to actually immediately communicate with so many people your thoughts and views, is it strange to go into the world of fiction then, where it's a very slow, laborious process, it takes long for the book to come out, and then it's possibly read by a relatively small number of people? Are the novels more important?
I'm aspiring to 600 people.
Yeah.
You can compare them, but they're very different in the sense that, I would spend a long time writing a book, and mm-hmm. then every single person who reads the book, mm. a new book is produced, because the way I would see the way Rachel looks like, anybody who reads that, they're going to see, even when they heard that, they probably in their minds, I saw a different person. There's always that little interaction. And because of that, it's the most intensely personal experience, I think. It's two imaginations coming together and making something. And so while you have communication in the media, it's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. I could come up with some tremendously clever thing to say that might change somebody's mind mm-hmm. from a minute-to-minute basis. Mm-hmm. I think a novel, though, stays with you because mm-hmm. it's not just a thought.
When you're in the media, you have to have a certain persona or a certain... You become a certain chameleon type of creature. That's the nature of not you, but anybody who's presenting anything. Whereas actually, when you actually go on down to write a novel, everything is stripped away. And you're actually getting down to a more essential sort of core. And there's a certain... you need to be more honest to a certain extent. I don't mean that you think it's dishonest, but there's nowhere else to hide.
I suppose my first novel... was just a straightforward thriller. That probably suffered a bit when it was first reviewed because I was on the telly being a smart arse. So mm-hmm. there was, like, in the first scene of this book, two hitmen go on a bus and shoot a mother and their child.
Yeah.
And then I saw a review on RTE where somebody said, it wasn't that funny. So they kind of missed the point somewhat, mm-hmm. you know. But hopefully I've kind of got over that now. But and that's the great joy. If you write something and the person forgets who wrote it mm-hmm. or anything like that, it's the people in the book, in their mind, and that world. If they become enmeshed in that, then
and the
that's the greatest
the difference
thing you can
also
do.
Is that the things in mass media are very immediate, they're very out there, and then they're very forgotten.
Whereas
books have been, and that we were discussing libraries and the future of libraries, and libraries are so important, and like books can be picked up in 5 years and 10 years, as a novel published in America after 18 years I've a plagiarism on in Gawk that was written 19 years ago and never done, and so they can actually have there's a strange permanence in books, and they do take on lives of their own, and they're read, and as you say, different people read them and put totally different interpretations on them. So we've been tracking this book around the world by satellite, and it is wonderful that when it actually came hover down in Tala, and
this
is the first reading you've done from it. And so it's been wonderful book, The Angel of the Street Lamps, and it's been a pleasure to talk to.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Red Lion Readings, a Curious broadcast production in partnership with South Dublin Libraries. Red Lion Readings was part of South Dublin Libraries Red Lion Book Festival and was curated by writer Dermot Bulger. You can podcast this programme on www.southdublinlibraries.com and on www.curiousbroadcast.com. Red Lion Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a broadcasting authority of Ireland Fund.